From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the Bletchley Park podcast. This episode, we're doing something a little bit different. And instead of commemorating a World War II anniversary, we are celebrating a podcast anniversary. So we are pleased to welcome you to our 10-year podcast anniversary special. With us are Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, Bletchley Park's research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheatham, and longtime friend of the podcast and GCHQ's former departmental historian, Tony Comer. We thought that this month we would look at Bletchley Park's most frequently asked question. So I will pass to David. What are we asked the most often here at Bletchley Park?
The thing that Tom and I are asked every time we give a tour and every time we give a presentation or anything else is, how was Bletchley Park kept secret? And the thing that people find very difficult to understand is that by the time it reached its peak in 1945, it was, as we frequently say, an organisation of nearly 9,000 people working on this site and its immediate outstations. And so, on the face of it, a very large body of people, not exactly in the middle of nowhere. I mean, Bletchley wasn't a very big place at the time, but it was still relatively close to London and everything else. We're not in the wilds of the Scottish mountains or something. So just how was the secret of what GCNCS was doing kept? And this is why we brought Tony in, because he has a great deal of expertise in, keeping secrets for a start, but also in the specific measures that were taken at Bletchley Park to preserve the secrecy of the operation. So to answer this question, Erica, I will leave you in the capable hands of Tom and Tony.
Thank you very much. Tom, I'm going to ask you first, how secret was Bletchley Park, really?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? And I suppose for my opening gambit here, I'm just going to tackle the myth head on, or a bit of mythology. People who've heard this podcast before will know I love busting a good myth. Secrecy is a bit of a stereotype about Bletchley Park, and it gets a bit silly. So let's just tackle that head on. For example, quite a lot of the time, people come up to me and they say, as a historian at Bletchley Park, it must be really difficult, because surely at the end of the war, they must have got all the documentation and made a big bonfire of it and destroyed everything, because that's how you keep things secret, right? That's how they keep things secret in the films anyway. And so we had this idea, what was sort of a Hollywood idea of how secret organisations work. And of course, the reality is a lot more prosaic than that, because this didn't happen. I mean, Bletchley Park and GCHQ going forward needed to keep records. They needed to keep institutional knowledge. If they burned everything, they'd really be shooting themselves in the foot. So they don't do this. The mind-blowing reality of secrecy is that they keep their documentation in a closed archive and they don't let anyone read it. That's how you keep an organisation secret. Nonetheless, you know, it is fair to say that secrecy is the dominant feature of what you might call the culture of Bletchley Park. Mm-hmm. And this is something that a historian I've got a great admiration for, Chris Gray, talks about in his book, which is called Decoding Organisation. He says it marks the main shared feature of BP culture. And he talks about how many secret organisations, they wear their secrecy as a sort of badge of honour. It is something that defines them and unites the people who belong to it and makes them members of an elite club. They are in on the secret. And Bletchley Park definitely had that tendency. We see it today with the veterans who we talk to who like to emphasise it as well. And we see also the public coming to us with that preconception that Bletchley's secret, and that's what marks it out. But what we'll see in this podcast is that secret organisations emphasise secrecy because it feels productive, because it increases a sense of exclusivity, not necessarily because it's a good idea, even though it's pointless or even counterproductive at times. And so secrecy is always a balance. This is something I think Tony will be able to tell us about from his own experience.
Tony, do you agree about the secret organisations wearing their secrecy as a badge of honour or being secret for secret's sake?
I think that's something that developed during the Second World War. You have to remember that the fact that there was a government code and cipher school was public knowledge. Its accounts were published in Hansard every year. It was coming to Bletchley and knowing that by September 1939, Alistair Denniston had already been told he could recruit up to 500 new members of staff, that this was going to be a new and a different organisation. And constructing the necessary secrecy in a place where nobody had ever heard of GCNCS, recruiting people who'd never been exposed to the need to keep state secrets before, was a challenge that it took quite a while for the organisation to embrace, though once it did, boy, did it embrace it.
How did they manage to convince people to keep the secret? How was secrecy maintained at Bletchley Park?
Quite simply by making it a condition of entry. The first thing you did when you came into Bletchley Park was to sign the Official Secrets Act. In itself, signing the Official Secrets Act has no value whatsoever. Everybody is subject to the Official Secrets Act, whether they're employed on secret work or not. But a very theatrical staging of something that says, if you ever reveal anything about what your work entails while you are at this place, can persuade people quite quickly that this is something really important. Still happens today. If you're recruited to GCHQ today, on your first morning, you will be asked to sign the Official Secrets Act. And it's a good way of concentrating people's minds and introducing them to the idea that this is a rather different culture.
I wonder if you could start by telling us how you actually ended up living here in the first place and when you moved here.
Well, in January 1938, my father came down here to work, and he said that we would move down here to live after the end of the summer term of school. And we came and we moved into number 2 cottage in 1938, and we stayed here until 1942. He showed us around the house, and I didn't like it. It was spooky. It was empty, not a stick of furniture anywhere. And I didn't go into the mansion again until after the war had started, when I had to go in and be interviewed for, you know, security reasons. It was rather funny, really, because my father really hammered it into us. You must not talk about anything. Well, he met me at the gate, and I thought, what the devil does he want? And he said, oh, some people want to talk to you. So we went into the mansion. I couldn't believe it. It was absolutely buzzing. Telephones, teleprinters, clattering noise, typewriters. And it was interesting because on all the doors, there were little plaques with numbers and letters on, no names. We went up to the first floor, and he pushed me into this room and said, there's some people want to talk to you. I'll wait out here. No explanation. And I went in, and I was confronted by a long table going from side to side, covered in a grey army blanket. Seated at the table, there were 3 very high-ranking officers, one from each of the services. In front of each man was a brand-new, unused notepad and a pencil and his service cap. And it amused me faintly because every peak of the service caps were pointing in the same direction, all very military. And the man in the middle was army. I think he was a colonel. And he set off by saying, you know, name and all that stuff. And then he said, when you're at school, do the other children ask you what's going on here? Oh, I said, yes, all the time. And they all leaned forward rather anxiously and said, and what do you say? So I said, well, it's just a lot of civil servants from London. Because that's what my father said, you know, you mustn't say anything else. So that seemed to satisfy them. And then he said, are you ever approached by grown-ups or on the train or in the town? I said, no. And that was it. And then he made a great long speech about how important Bletchley Park was and that it was absolutely vital that nothing should be discussed or given away at all. And he really hammered this point home. And then he fished into his briefcase and put out a document in front of me and said rather solemnly, this is the Official Secrets Act. I could see that because it was on the top. And he said, it's a solemn pledge, a solemn promise, because this place has got to be kept very secret. And he went on and on. And then he handed me a very, very posh fountain pen. And he said, you must write your name in capitals there, and then sign it and date it. So I did that, and he said, thank you for coming. And I went to join my father. And as I went out, I heard someone chuckle. And I was a prickly little devil, actually. And I said, they're laughing at me. He said, no, they aren't. He said, they're laughing because you're the youngest ever to sign the OSA. But I was 13. And You know, they needn't have bothered. It was obviously very, very heavily stage managed to impress a schoolgirl. But as I said, I'd had it dinned into me, my father, so they were, you know, it was really a bit of a rain dance.
The problem the management have after a while, bringing so many people in, and in many cases, you're talking about young people, especially young women, maybe their first time away from home, maybe the first job they'd ever had. In a completely new environment, obviously it's pretty overwhelming. We all know what first day of a new job is like. And they sat down and they signed this document, but they don't really absorb it. And people at Bletchley Park who are worried about security, people like Nigel de Grey, who's the sort of second in command to Edward Travis and general troubleshooter throughout the war, are worried about the ramifications of this. So in 1942, we see that initial quite wordy document people are expected to sign is supplemented by a new one, and it is much more direct and to the point and conversational. And you have this almost poster, which is headed simply secrecy in big letters.
OUP Form Number 18. Secrecy. This may seem a simple matter. It should be. But repeated experience has proved that it is not. Even for the cleverest of us, even for the least important. Month after month, instances have occurred where workers at BP have been heard casually saying outside BP things that are dangerous. It is not enough to know that you must not hint at these things outside. It must be uppermost in your mind every hour that you talk to outsiders. Even the most trivial-seeming things matter. The enemy does not get his intelligence by great scoops, but from a whisper here, a tiny detail there. Therefore, do not talk at meals. There are the waitresses and others who may not be in the know regarding your own particular work. Do not talk in the transport. There are the drivers who should not be in the know. Do not talk travelling. Indiscretions have been overheard on Bletchley platform. They do not grow less serious further off. Do not talk in your billet. Why expect your hosts, who are not pledged to secrecy, to be more discreet than you, who are? Do not talk by your own fireside, whether here or on leave. If you are indiscreet and tell your own folks, they may see no reason why they should not do likewise. They are not in a position to know the consequences, and have received no guidance. Moreover, if one day invasion came, as it perfectly well may, Nazi brutality might stop at nothing to wring from those that you care for secrets that you would give anything, then, to have saved them from knowing. Their only safety will lie in utter ignorance of your work. Be careful, even in your hut. Cleaners and maintenance staff have ears, and are human. There is nothing to be gained by chatter but the satisfaction of idle vanity or idle curiosity. There is everything to be lost. The very existence of our work here, the lives of others, even the war itself. People will always be curious. They can always learn something from your answers, if you answer, even though you only answer yes or no. Do not suggest, as is so easy and so flattering to human vanity, that you are doing something very important and very hush-hush. Far too many people in England know that about Bletchley Park already. If ever the Germans come to know it, we may find ourselves a German target for tonight. There are drawbacks to publicity. The only way, then, is to cut the conversation short. For example, question. What are you doing now? Answer. Working for the Foreign Office, or other ministry as appropriate. Question. But what do you do? Answer. Oh, work. A gay reticence in that vein will win you far more real respect from anyone worth respecting than idle indiscretion or self-important airs of mystery. There is an English proverb none the worse for being 7 centuries old. Wicked tongue breaketh bone, though the tongue itself hath none. I hereby promise that no word of mine shall betray, however slightly, the great trust placed in me. Signed.
What you can hear from this document is that it's not legalistic language at all. And also, it's quite constructive and gives you ideas as to how to actually handle secrecy on a day-to-day basis. This is the sort of briefing staff really need when they join. So the week they start, they're given this initial warning, they sign the act, and then they go into the office. But they also have to attend a security lecture sometime later in the week, and it was initially on Thursday and then later on Sunday, I believe. And they have two different lectures initially. They have a 10 to 10:30 lecture for those in cryptographic or intelligence roles where they're going to be handling actual, you know, the real material, who know codes are going to be broken. And they have a lecture immediately after 10:30 to 11 for everybody else, people working in communications, maybe the cleaners, people who aren't handling the material, but who might come across it in their day-to-day duties. And presumably they've got a guard on the door to stop early arrivals to the second session, wandering in and hearing the secret of Enigma breaking. But after these lectures, everyone's given this form and they're invited to take it away for 48 hours. They have to return it signed to the security officer in their section. Every section's got somebody who's, as a sort of part-time role, keeps an eye on secrecy in general in the office. But they can take this document away, they can read it in their billet, they can really mull it over and think about it and absorb it. That is therefore a very useful supplement to the original Official Secrets Act to really get the message across and give people some practical ideas about how to handle keeping your mouth shut on a day-to-day basis.
So, Tony, who was it that actually came up with this process of the security lectures and the forms and so on?
It was a man called Henry Hayward, who was appointed a senior security officer at the beginning of 1942. And he'd seen the way things had worked from the arrival at Bletchley Park and how really people had tried to be too clever. In fact, originally in 1938, when GCNCS came to Bletchley at the time of the Munich crisis, it was decided to issue a cover story that here were people who'd come to prepare for the air defence of London. There were two problems. First of all, a staff of university lecturers and linguists did not seem very appropriate for the air defence of London. And anyway, London's quite a few miles away from Bletchley. But second, the staff weren't told what the cover story was. This was a bit of a problem. In October 1939, Nigel de Grey came up with Government Communications Headquarters as a cover title for the organisation. But again, the first staff knew of it was arriving at work one day and seeing that somebody had put a great board outside the site saying Government Communications Headquarters and all turning to each other and saying, oh, what does that mean? It's what happens. Nobody's ever done anything on this sort of scale before. And the different attempts that people had really weren't working too well. There are lots of stories about, for example, you know, the need to be careful in letters home. At first, people were told you can only say you work at Station X, and you weren't allowed to say that that was at Bletchley. What happened when people wanted to bring their family fairly close, those who were able to? So they were given an address, Room 47 Foreign Office, and this was the cover address for everybody for correspondence to and from Bletchley Park. Allegedly, that lasted until the day somebody arranged to have a motorbike sent to Room 47 at the Foreign Office, and the Foreign Office actually finally held the hands up and complained. And at that point, a PO box number for Bletchley was set up. Though even then, there was a separate PO box number in London for any international correspondence. The thing is, they'd not managed this before. People were just trying to do the best they could. And it took bringing everything together under the responsibility of a single senior security officer for a consistent and coherent plan to be developed.
2nd of August, 1939. Move of service sections to war site, 15th of August, 1939. In order to carry out communication tests, the war site will be manned AM 15th August by those detailed in GCNCS first wave, who are not on leave at the time. The staff are warned against any conversations regarding the work with other members of the staff whilst in their billets. If occasion should arise as to what you are doing, the answer should be that you are part of the aerial defence of London. The address for official correspondence and private letters will be Room 47 Foreign Office, and the official telephone number, Whitehall 7947.
So one of the things that Henry Hayward decided he needed to do was try to persuade people that security was part of their job. Security wasn't something that was done to them or that was somewhere to the side of the building of Bolton. It was something they all had to internalise. And so he designed the lecture that preceded new members of staff signing his official declaration. And he worked out what the key points that he felt that he had to bring were. The first was to explain the provisions of the Official Secrets Act. Now, if you ever read the Official Secrets Act that was the 1920 Official Secrets Act that was in place at that time, it's a complex document full of obscure provisions. So explaining that what it meant was that anything you see at work stays at work. You can't talk about it when you go home. You can't tell your three best friends. You can't tell your parents. What happens in the office must stay in the office. That was really important. And having told them that, he then went on to say what GCNCS was. We've already heard that there were two separate lectures, one given to the people who were actually working on the core intelligence mission of Bletchley Park, the other given to people who were in more peripheral roles. But both sets of people had to go away understanding that what went on in this place was vital to the security of the United Kingdom. And his next point was to say that the work of Bletchley Park was operational. This was to support the military operations that the UK and its allies were taking part in. This wasn't just something relatively trivial. This was right at the heart of the nation's war effort. And therefore, it was something that could be lost. Careless talk really could cost lives. If the enemy countries, if the Axis countries were to find out what went on at Bletchley Park, they could do things that would make the successful support to military operational activity become worthless. And this is sort of in the middle of his lecture, he came out with his aphorism. There is only one way of keeping a secret, and that is to tell it to nobody. And you can imagine by now his desired effect was to have a crowd of maybe 40 or 50 people beginning to cower in their seats, thinking of the tremendous responsibility that was being put on to their shoulders. But he carried on and started to talk more about what they could do to make sure that they protected the information that they were seeing. And much of that was about behaviour, you know, not surrounding yourself with mystery. He'd help them by giving them answers to casual questions, or perhaps teaching them how to treat more specific questions as though they were casual. You know, what do you do? I'm in admin. Is about the most boring possible answer to a question as a way of turning people off. All I ever do is just write letters that other people have composed. There are ways of indicating, deflecting people's questions by indicating that you're not actually that important a person after all. Not to write indiscreet letters, though again, this had to be spelled out. Perhaps the most egregious example of somebody who thought she was doing the right thing was the young woman who wrote home to her mother to say, unfortunately, all leave has been cancelled, so I can't come home at the weekend because of the invasion of Sicily. Luckily, that letter was intercepted because it was an example of somebody who was very well-meaning. She was just telling her mother why she couldn't come home. That was the reason she'd been told her leave was cancelled, so she wrote it in a letter. But this was, again, part of what Hayward was doing, was arranging periodically for the censorship to actually examine letters coming to and from members of staff just to check that things were being done in a proper manner. And they discovered that people made silly mistakes, but there was no particular evidence of venality. And perhaps his final thing, and ones I hope we get to talk about in a bit more detail later, is the principle of the need to know. I don't think it had ever been enunciated in such a clear way as came after the first break into Enigma. And this was something that came from the Prime Minister and from Sir Stuart Mingis, the Chief of the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, down. And that was the minimum amount of knowledge had to be shared with the minimum number of people. I mean, Mingis, right up to 1952, at his last appearance before the London Signal Intelligence Board actually said that he was convinced that it was only by the most rigid imposition of security that we had won the last war, and tried to persuade the next generation of intelligence officers that rigid secrecy, rigid compartmentation was the only way to protect secrets. Well, it worked. It certainly helped protect secrets, but at quite a cost. At this stage in the war, however, it was still thought to be the very best way of preserving secrecy was by rigorously limiting the number of people who were exposed to any part of it.
We'll come back to the idea of compartmentalisation, I think, in a minute, but I just want to really highlight the paradox that's in the middle of Hayward's approach and Nigel de Grey's approach as well. I think this is well understood and is discussed at the top of the organisation, is that you have to lessen secrecy a little bit to keep everything secret. You have to get people to understand why the secrecy is required, and that requires giving them a bit of information. If you just tell people nothing, that might work when you've got a small organisation which is tight-knit and highly motivated and in touch with the work. But as the organisation gets bigger, the jobs are more menial, it's just not going to fly anymore. And it's well illustrated by a quote I've got here from one of the documents I found in the archives. Much play is made on secrecy, but the operator, they're talking about the Y station operators here, but it's the same at Bletchley, the operator is not guided as to what he may tell people. And obviously, what he must not tell is that his work is highly secret. So if you tell people just, it's secret, don't tell anyone, all they know is that it's secret, and the only thing they can give away down the pub to their mates is that they do something top secret, and that's the number one thing they must not tell anyone. It gives a complete game away. So what we see paradoxically is to keep things really secret, the management have to loosen security, they have to give a little bit of information away in the interests of the greater good and the long-term security of the whole effort. And I think that paradox is really interesting.
It gives a purpose for these security lectures rather than particularly these peripheral staff, as you were saying, simply being told, don't talk about it. They need that context in order to understand why. So even though people were told in great detail, not just not to talk about it, but why not to talk about it, have you found any examples of people talking?
It's not true to say that most people were insecure or that the security of Bletchley Park was particularly bad, but there are many, many examples of security being badly applied and people breaking the rules.
I think this will come as a bit of a surprise to some of our listeners as well, who believe that absolutely everybody kept tight-lipped 100%.
And this is absolutely not to denigrate our veterans at all, or denigrate the people who work here, because this was, as Tony suggested earlier, probably inevitable. Some people will make slip-ups. Some people will just misunderstand what's expected of them in a completely good-faith way. And very few people do any of this stuff on purpose.
Can you give us some examples then of these people being indiscreet or speaking when they shouldn't have?
Okay, so I've got a bit of a list here, so I'll just start going for it. Again, relating to the Y stations. Very early in the war, right at the start of 1940, when Enigma has just been broken up Bletchley, the Chatham Y stations, this is the main army strategic intercept station, which is intercepting most of the Enigma at that point, was sent a teleprint from Bletchley Park, and that was handled by the teleprint staff at Chatham, who were meant to know nothing. And the teleprint read, please repeat message such and such as we are waiting to decode it. So somebody's made a mess up there. And similarly, later in the same year, Chatham is told to send the preambles of messages, so sort of metadata about the messages, to Bletchley Park as soon as they were intercepted, and send the actual message content on later. And then at a certain time of day, they're told to stop sending those preambles because they don't need them anymore. They're told this over the telephone. And one day, the Chatham member of staff taking the message, I quote, noted a background of cheers at the intelligence centre. On inquiring whether there was a party there, the reply was, don't you know we've just broken the red? And from that day on, any instruction to stop sending these preambles through to Bletchley Park was greeted with cheers by the Chatham teleprinter staff. So they knew exactly what was going on at the Y stations almost as soon as they started breaking Enigma. So I suppose those are a couple of examples of where procedures needed to be tightened up. You have leaks into the press. In February 1941, the Daily Mirror publishes an article headlined, Spies Tap Nazi Code. And this piece is about the interceptors again, especially those in the Radio Security Service, the RSS, these what are called volunteer interceptors, who are radio amateurs enlisted to listen into the messages of the German secret services. It says, questions are parried with a smile or silence. Their job isn't one to be talked about. Until the small hours, they sit, headphones on ears, taking down the Morse code messages which fill the air. And MI5 got on this very quickly. They got the article removed from later editions of the paper, but it did go out into print early on. And also in 1941, there is a book published called Diary of a Staff Officer by a Major Gribble. And he talks about using special intelligence in France, but it's very thinly disguised. It's quite clear to anyone in the know that he's talking about signals intelligence.
Actually, I managed to find a copy of the book, and it's quite clear where the references are to SIGINT, and it comes just at the point when there is a flood of SIGINT hitting the GHQ in France. There's not much idea, actually, that the intelligence staff in France was able to cope with the intelligence it was receiving, which is another problem perhaps to discuss on another day. But the very disingenuous Major Gribble claimed that because he had submitted the manuscript of his book to the War Office censors and they hadn't seen any problem with it, he thought it was okay to talk about this material.
Hello? Ah, hello, sir. Rightio. Well, if you could leave this with me, sir, I'll just give it a quick once over and be back to you in a jiffy. Until then, sir. Goodbye.
These kinds of procedural errors and indiscretions, is this something that we really only see at the beginning of the war as people are sort of starting to establish these procedures? Or is this stuff happening throughout?
I've got a good late war example that shows that that's not the case. These problems were never truly solved. June 1945, they've already beaten Germany, but they've still got to beat Japan. And Robert Gore Brown, who's the officer in charge of security at the special liaison units, and another of these general security troubleshooting sort of chaps, goes to the War Office one day and he discovers they have a secure ultra room there where all this material is kept. And this room is used by a mix of workers, some fully in the ultra picture, some partly in the picture, and some not in the picture at all. And it's also being used as a break room for tea breaks. And so everyone's gathering in the ultra room to have a natter over a tea and biscuits. Nigel de Grey comments on this, "I shudder to think what sort of report would go back to America were they to know that Japanese ultra pass through a room in which people not on the list enter for the purposes of having tea. In Washington, you have to produce about 6 different coloured badges before you're allowed near an ultra room." So I think it's fair to say from examples like this, things are never completely watertight, organisationally speaking.
Whilst not trivial, these don't seem to be particularly severe examples of enormous breaches of that kind of security. Have you got any other examples that were considered perhaps far more serious?
I have a couple that actually came earlier in the war. And they came at the same time. One was a young man who worked here who went back to his college for a dinner one weekend and told the assembled high table all about the problems that they were having with German naval traffic since the introduction of the fourth rotor on the submarine Enigma. And at just about the same time, they learned of another story of a young woman who worked here who had been bullied and pressured by her father when she'd been at home on leave one weekend to say exactly what it was that she was doing. And both of these stories became known. Both of them were thought of as actually severe breaches of security. In fact, they went as far as the JIC because the management at Bletchley thought that these were exemplary cases and should be dealt with by prosecution of the two members of staff. But the chief of MI6 was absolutely insistent that not even an in-camera trial would be secure enough to resolve these issues.
What is an in-camera trial?
An in-camera trial is one in which no members of the public or the press are allowed to be present. So it still potentially would happen if there was ever a prosecution under Section 1 of the Official Secrets Act, when the secrets are so sensitive that they can't be made public, even in the trial of the person who's revealed them to an enemy, for example. In this case, however, the chief of the Secret Intelligence Service, worked out that an in-camera trial would still involve somewhere between 70 and 80 people finding out what the actual offence was, from the judge, the jury, the defence and prosecution counsels, the solicitors, the stenographers, all of the people who necessarily have to be in a courtroom. And he said that he was not prepared to see Ultra put at risk by having so many more people brought into the know. So in the two cases, the young woman was sacked and her father, who I think seems to be the villain of this particular piece, was brought into the War Office for what used to be called an interview without coffee. he was going to learn the error of his ways. The young man got off very lightly. It was decided to put him under more close supervision. And when it was discovered subsequently that both his parents were committed members of the Communist Party, people realised that perhaps this might have been a bigger problem than had originally been thought.
What's interesting about both these cases is they're not kept under wraps. They're not just known about by the managers. They're actually brought to the attention of all the staff. And Travis issues quite a long memo to everybody in the organisation, laying out the basic facts of both cases and explaining that this wasn't acceptable, reiterating the need for secrecy, basically letting people know he was really disappointed. And so turning these breaches into a learning experience for the staff. And again, that document was expected to be distributed to everyone. Everyone was to read it from start to finish and sign it and return it so that everybody had seen it.
Only the intervention of the director, who wished to prevent the organisation from coming under public discredit, save the two individuals guilty of these acts of indiscretion from conviction and imprisonment, they have been suitably dealt with. And though they have escaped imprisonment, the anxiety and humiliation to which these proceedings will have subjected them and their families, no less than the realisation of the dangers to which they have exposed their country, will no doubt be some, if not equal, punishment. I am, however, to tell you that if, after this serious warning of the danger and criminality of indiscretion, of the disclosure, that is, of any information whatever gained by you in the course of your official duties to anyone not entitled to such knowledge, has been so solemnly brought home to you, if, as I say, any similar instance reaches my notice, there will be no leniency shown, and the director will not again intervene, but will let the law take its course. You will yourselves feel that no punishment can be too severe for anyone who endangers the lives of our men. And I must insist that you take this matter of security to heart, and hope that I shall not again have to subject you to the indignity of such a warning.
And they do this several times. Actually, Denniston is doing the same thing in 1940, saying, I've learnt of somebody speaking in a local hotel, saying things they shouldn't have done. This is unacceptable. They try and turn these into learning experiences for the staff. And I think that reflects, you know, there are limitations to what the management can do. As Tony says, you put people on trial, that risks an even bigger security breach. Often it's better to give them a slap on the wrist, keep them in the organisation where you can keep an eye on them, try and scare them and make them understand the error of their ways, make it a learning process for everybody else. But you don't actually invoke the Official Secrets Act because it's meant to be a deterrent. And once you're in a position to prosecute someone under the Act, the horse has already bolted, the horse has gone over the hill, and it has already failed to serve its purpose. And at that point, you're better being lenient, actually, rather than bringing the book down on people.
When we're talking about the consequences, Tony, you mentioned about somebody being sacked. Do you think there's not an inherent risk in sacking someone that has all that knowledge they've acquired from working at Bletchley Park?
There is. And in the specific case, I think the judgment was that the whole family had been made to become thoroughly ashamed of everything that had happened, and that it was as much in their interests that no more should be said about the story as in Bletchley Park's.
I've got an even better example of the circumstances under which you might sack someone, which is when they just don't get it. So we have Elizabeth Hall. She's age 21. She'd been working at Bletchley Park for about 6 weeks, living in the women's hostel, which is just outside the main gate, for young women who just left home for the first time. And she was working in Mr. White's section, the cipher office, which we've talked about before, is probably the number one worst place to work at Bletchley Park. They are encoding and decoding Allied communications coming in and out of the site using Type-X machines. It's physically demanding work. It's complete drudgery. It's mind-numbingly boring. The office environment is unpleasant and uncomfortable. The management is distant and uncaring. And morale is terrible. She's very lonely after 6 weeks here, so she invites a friend down from Coventry, who's a Christine McCabe, a worker in an aircraft factory, to visit for the weekend. And firstly, she brings her friend Christine into the hostel and has to go on night shift. So she leaves her in the hostel among all the Bletchley Park workers overnight. Not too bad, maybe. They make breakfast in the room in the morning, on Saturday morning, because apparently it was the practice for residents to bring food into the rooms and cook and eat in the rooms. Went for a walk in the morning and then they had a nap in the afternoon. And then she decides to let her visiting friend into Bletchley Park. Elizabeth goes through the main gate using her pass. She walks down the fence a short distance. She hands her pass back through the gate to her friend. And her friend comes in and meets her inside the gate. And first they go to the mansion where they have a club room where they have sort of recreational activities and spend some time in there. And then they sit by the lake for a little bit. And then they go to the cafeteria. And Elizabeth takes an extra meal ticket for her friend, so they both have dinner in the cafeteria, and they go back to the hostel again. The following day, Elizabeth doesn't feel like having lunch, so she gives her friend her pass and another meal ticket and sends her off to the cafeteria on her own, unaccompanied. And then when she comes back, the people who run the hostel seem to, at this point, have cottoned on to what's going on, that there is this complete unknown wandering around Bletchley Park. And they tell the friend to go and get Elizabeth, the worker, from her room. And Elizabeth then decides, instead of coming clean, going to the management and accepting she'd done wrong, she decides to take her friend to the station and put her on a train back to Coventry, which is probably not the most tactful move in the situation. Then she hands herself into the authorities. So you can imagine they were not very happy with her after this. And because she had not been working at Bletchley for too long, because she was in a section where the workers knew literally nothing, she is dismissed from Bletchley Park and they decide just to... If somebody really has that little understanding of the expectations, then the risk is too great of keeping them around, so she's dismissed.
Sounds like she didn't pay attention in the security lecture, for a start.
It sounds like she was enormously naive. Mm-hmm. I don't say this to denigrate her at all, if any of her relatives are listening. But there is a need for having a much better understanding of, you know, even a basic level of understanding of the secrecy required would mean that she would never have done any of those things.
Do we know what happened to Christine, the friend?
No, the document I read, she went straight back to Coventry. I don't know whether they followed it up. It may have been judged that since Elizabeth didn't know anything and Christine only, you know, she'd got into the canteen, but that was about as bad as it got. She probably didn't pick up any knowledge she shouldn't have. Maybe she was vetted. I'd expect she was vetted afterwards to ensure there weren't any links there and maybe kept an eye on. But I suspect they didn't go to her and say, you've broken the Official Secrets Act, because it's best to keep her in the dark.
In some notes that Nigel de Grey wrote in 1949, he has as one of his headings of problems, stupid girls.
That's very Nigel de Grey. Yes. He rarely uses the word girls in a positive sense in his writings.
But he could have been thinking about this particular pair when he wrote it. So this is probably the first part of answering the question that David posed initially and saying that the sort of the camaraderie of people who haven't been caught out, who are learning about what happens if you are found out, is one of the clues to why people kept the secret. How did so many people keep the secrets? Luckily there, but for the grace of God, you know, they'd gone or their friends had gone. And every time you hear of one of these cases, it might just make you sort of stop and think, that's not going to happen to me.
There is a point here that, you know, our modern visitors forget, which is that we nowadays have, ironically, a much stronger idea of our own privacy and what the government shouldn't know about us. But at the same time, our right to know everything about what's going on in the world. And that just wasn't the case in the 1940s. There was a much greater respect for authority in that sense. If the government or senior figures of whatever kind told you something, you kind of did what you were told. But also, people nowadays forget the level of threat. During World War II, especially in the early years, there is a genuine belief that the Germans could be walking through that door any day. And if Britain falls to the Nazis and everything has gone terribly wrong, you don't want to be the one lying in bed going, that was actually my fault. The self-imposed pressure to not be the one that lets the team down is something that comes out in a lot of the veteran testimony we've got and the memoirs and things, that people are frightened. They're not frightened of the consequences or being prosecuted or whatever. They're frightened of the embarrassment, the stigma, the moral burden of being the person who's given the game away. And I'm sure it's anecdotal rather than real, but there is the story about not wanting to go to the dentist and be anaesthetised in case you blabbed in your sleep and things like that. And I'm sure that's not a real thing, but it's the sort of, it captures the spirit of the idea that people were imposing pressure on themselves to not be the weak link. And especially if you consider this predominantly female workforce, almost every one of them would have had close or extended family on the fighting fronts. And you know, if your brother is in France, you don't want to be the one that gets him killed. And so it kind of self-polices in that way. How do you motivate people with that these days, Tony? I mean, it could be argued that we are still under existential threat from various places.
The world's different. The world is very different. People are going in, joining GCHQ, knowing what they're joining and knowing what it does, and knowing that they are not going to be able to talk about their work.
I suppose people who are joining now are, as you say, aware of the task and are putting themselves forward to do the job, whereas a lot of the people we're talking about at Bletchley Park have been, for example, they're women plucked from the military services who are sent here with no decision to come here and no knowledge of what's happening. So they're plunged into a situation that isn't of their own creation in any way.
And there's even less likelihood nowadays that you've got people who've got a relation in the armed forces on a fighting front.
This is Mark, the producer of the podcast. As Erica said at the start of the show, this is our 10th anniversary episode. And so for once, I'm going to interrupt with some more recent history. It was back in the summer of 2012 that I started to dream up the idea of this podcast. I've produced every single show, but there's been a lot of people down the years who've helped make it happen. And I'm sure on this one occasion, you can indulge me a few minutes just to thank some of them. The very first has to be the CEO of Bletchley Park Trust, Ian Standen. From the first time I pitched him the idea of the podcast, he's always been 100% behind us. So, kind of without him, there had never been a show. It's the continuing support of Ian, the Trust and Rebecca Foy that brings you these shows. Also instrumental at the start of the podcast was our original host, Catherine Lynch. I'll always be immensely grateful for her 6 years of sterling service. Then, the current podcast team. I can always rely on them to Max Shaw. There's our brilliant host, guest wrangler and Bletchley's own exhibitions manager, Erica. Our own brace of historians, David and Thomas, who I can say hand on heart teach me something new about wartime SIGINT in every show. All our amazingly generous and talented voiceover actors who have all given their time and voices for free. Dr. Ben Thompson, Owen Moogan, Gus Munro, Stephen Wilson, Jeffrey Welshman and Sarah Langston. We've had a bunch of roving reporters who've helped us at our reunions, including Sarah Langston, Kerry Howard, Astrid Specht and the late Helen Lee. It's at those reunions we get to meet the most important people in this podcast, the veterans of Bletchley Park. It's always been an honour to be in their company and I can never thank them enough for giving us their time and allowing us to share their stories with the world. We thank each and every one of them for their service. Then, of course, the people doing their job now. So at GCHQ, both the former and current departmental historians, Tony Comer and David Abrutat, and the media team for all their help down the years. There have been a lot of people who've worked in Bletchley's comms team over the last decade, but it's Melanie, Isaac and Annie who currently have the unenviable task of dealing with me. Audio Boom, for their amazing support in hosting the show for us. A special mention has to go out to Lance Patterson for years of tech support. Finally, the syrupy bit. And that's to you, our loyal listeners, because every time one of you posts about the podcast on social media or especially when you leave a review, you help to promote the show, which is the lifeblood for an independent production like this. So thank you very much. Not many podcasts get to celebrate their 10th birthday. So after 10 years, 242 shows and more than 170 hours of content later, this is still the thing I'm most proud to have created. Here's to the next 10, That's enough of me. Now back to the show.
We've been talking about how people at Bletchley Park, the staff, kept the secret. Can you tell me about people outside the wire? How were they prevented from getting in and learning about what was happening and taking place here?
One of the things they decided fairly early on was that they would need to secure Bletchley Park itself. They gave quite a lot of thought to what it should look like. You know, should it have lots of rolls of barbed wire? Should it be sort of permanently patrolled by the military? And they decided in the end that they would do something that was simpler and wouldn't draw excessive attention to the site. In fact, what they ended up using was a chain wire fence with the sort of the diamond pattern. And that could be expanded as the site expanded. The wire fence could be expanded as well. It wasn't very secure. In fact, famously, during one Home Guard exercise, the attacking platoon, instead of investing the gatehouse, simply used a spanner to remove a section of the chain wire and very unsportingly attacked the guard force from the rear. But it did the job. It sort of let people know that this was a private, secure area. In the same as sort of dealing with classified waste, I mean, 250,000 incoming or outgoing messages every single week. What do you do with all of that paper? The answer is you pulp it, you recycle it. You know, the country was very short of paper. But that all had to be done in town. It had to be done at the paperworks in Bletchley. And I think basically everybody knew there was a large government organisation. People might draw their own conclusions at whatever point during the war that the Intelligence Corps and the Royal Corps of Signals started to wear shoulder flashes. It became quite clear that there were a large number of servicemen who were here and, as I said earlier, that something was going on. But if you don't draw attention to it particularly, I think local people just accepted that here was this large establishment in their midst.
I mean, this links to what David was saying before about culture, because this culture of secrecy at Bletchley is mirrored in the culture of secrecy of British society more broadly during the war, because everyone knows that loose lips sink ships. So the local people are just very happy to accept that there are these strangers in their midst, and it is not their business to know what they do, and it's not their right to know what goes on within Bletchley Park. And that's a really important part of making the system work. I've come across another really interesting example in the security files of one of the local people actually helping the security forces out. This is a billeter of our old friend Jimmy Fersk. And what's really satisfying actually is the documentation in the archives matches up with what James tells us in his book. And it's really nice when that happens. So his billeter, a Mrs. Jones, is on the train from Oxford one day. And there's a man in her compartment who talks about delivering special engine parts to Bletchley Park. And I quote, "They were," he said, "the only examples of their kinds in the world." He's said to have mentioned that at Bletchley Park, there was a special machine for detecting voices. Also, he said, there's 5,000 of them there, and it's going to be there after the war. And under investigation, it turned out this man, he was quite distinctive. He was quite a portly gentleman, apparently. So he stood out quite well among the relatively emaciated people of Bletchley. He was discovered to be a Mr. Boucher of the Ricardo Engine Company based in Oxford, which was supplying Bletchley Park. And apparently he made these remarks. His excuse was he was overcome with gratitude to a fellow passenger for looking after his seat. You know, when you're in that awkward situation where you ask someone for help on public transport and then you feel you have to strike a conversation with them and give away national secrets. We've all been there. De Grey remarked about him, obviously the type of chap who tells what he knows. So they marked him down. But we also have a statement from Mrs. Jones on this. She witnessed this happening. She went to the Bletchley Park authorities and she knew Bletchley Park was not a place to be talked about, and she told them about it. And then she said in her statement at the end, "I was very surprised at this careless talk. I've never been warned not to talk. My own common sense tells me not to talk." And that is exactly the attitude of the local people which Bletchley is able to exploit. And as I say, is a really important element in how it was kept secret.
And as we know, people weren't living specifically on site within the wire. So Bletchley Park staff were living with these kind of people. This woman who says it was her sense not to talk at all. that's the case, isn't it, Tony, that these people were actually living in the same houses as people who were working at Bletchley Park and still the secret was kept?
Everybody was either billeted on a family in Bletchley or in the immediate area, apart from, of course, the service people who lived on their camps. But it meant that in lots of ways, the people who were living in the houses of local residents became as though they were part of the family. You know, they would go to work every day. They would come home from work every day. And the fact that they weren't talking about what they did when they were in the camp, the fact that what they did was government work and secret, probably helped in the local area create a class of people who didn't ask and who were protective. They were probably very good at informing the local police, for example, if anybody strange came or appeared to be listening to conversations in pubs.
You've mentioned there was a fence around Bletchley Park keeping one side out from the other. Obviously, in a fence, there has to be a gate. Can you tell us more about the security controls of how to get in and out of Bletchley Park?
It was a relatively simple process. Everybody who worked on site received a pass that they had to carry with them and they had to show when they came on and off site. Visitors would get a temporary pass in the way probably that most people who work in office buildings nowadays are used to. Obviously, the passes weren't electronic. They were small cardboard things with a photograph on. And at busy times, although everybody was supposed to show their pass to a guard on the gate, probably far more typical that people would just wave this piece of card in the general direction. Perhaps an additional layer of security came from the fact that the permanent guards on the gate were recruited by the Foreign Office from retired members of the Metropolitan Police. Some of these stayed for the whole of the war, and they got to know the people who were coming in and out every day. And perhaps the best security of all is being admitted to the site by somebody who recognises you and knows already that you're entitled to be there.
I believe there's a story about you and the daily passwords.
Oh, God, that was awful. Well, what happened was they had this, well, now I think of it, it was a daft system. When the big steel fence went up with the barbed wire on the top, which incidentally incorporated a much, much bigger area than the original little crude wooden fence, and they had these passwords. Well, they were changed at 8:30. And I caught my train at 8:30 to school. It was one station up the line. And so when I came in the afternoon, I never knew it. And the people on the gate used to say, oh, hello, and how are you? Good day at school, you know, chatty like that. And then they would march me up to the mansion for formal identification. And I said, look, this is ridiculous. You know who I am. And I would go up to the mansion, and my name would be written in a book, the time of arrival, and that was it. And I really got fed up with this. And I said, why do you do this? You know that I live here. You know who I am. It is procedure. But it didn't last long. We had passes after that. It was much easier.
So even if people did have a familiar face to the guards on the gate, they still had to get their security passes checked. That must have quite annoyed them, surely, every single day, having to line up in order to get into work.
Yeah, it really did. And looking at the records, you can see what difficult job this was for the security people. Because quite rightly, their job's worse and they try and make people stick to the rules and enforce them. But the people working at Bletchley are often not interested in complying with the rules. They're overworked. They're often in a hurry. They are living in quite bad conditions sometimes. They are naturally not very cooperative sometimes. For example, there is a Miss Howe who's recorded as reporting without her pass 6 times in the year 1943 and 10 times in the first half of 1944. And she basically gets written up over this and reprimanded, and once again arrives without her pass, and her remark is how ridiculous the whole thing is. And Henry Hayward, who is in the security office on that day, responds to her, of all the people who are attached to this establishment, you have the worst record for coming in without your pass, and therefore you should be the last to complain. It is through the likes of you that this order was made. So he's, you know, having to enforce the rules, but there are members of staff who just aren't interested in complying. An even worse case, there's one of the Hollerith supervisors, who I won't name, who comes in. He's sent into the security office because he's late for work, and they take down the names of everyone who's late for work, and all they have to do is pop into the office and give their names. He looks into the security office, and from the doorway wanted to know the reason he had been sent in. I informed him that it was no doubt on account of his late arrival, whereby certain conditions had to be complied with. He then said, the sentry wants to get a gun and shoot himself. He then left the office doorway and hurried away without filling in a late duty form. The sentry on gate duty examining passes then came into the security office and stated he had directed him to report through being late and had been told to go to hell. So not very pleasant behaviour sometimes on show that these security guards are having to deal with. The other thing is they're having to act as general police, not just for Bletchley Park itself, but for the wider area sometimes. There is a lot of patrolling the site and finding huts that have been left wide open with confidential documents on display. Lots of theft as well. Lots of warnings having to go out to the staff. Don't leave stuff in your offices. Don't leave stuff in unlocked cars. There's one occasion where a staff member left some luggage in the hallway of the mansion. You can see it was a different time, really. She left her luggage in the hallway of the mansion and came back several days later and was surprised to find that it disappeared. There's also the case of an MTC, so this is Mechanized Transport Corps driver, who's living in the women's hostel again. And the MTC tends to recruit from upper-class young ladies. And she goes to the security guards and reports that she's lost £400 worth of jewellery, which doesn't seem that bad in today's money. But then I realised that if you look at a skilled member of staff at Bletchley, a middle-ranking cryptanalyst, maybe in Hut 6, would earn about £300 a year. And this lady has just lost £400 worth of jewellery and decided, again, that was appropriate to bring that to Bletchley Park and leave that in her hostel room. So that was something they had to bring to the attention of the police. There's also some quite, you know, concerning incidents which resonate quite powerfully today, actually. There is an occasion in 1943 where two women are walking to Bletchley to come on shift and are followed by a man who appears under Bletchley Railway Bridge and then all of a sudden are grabbed by this man. And one of the women ran to the main gate and managed to get away. She reports the incident to the staff there, but initially they don't really pay any attention to her because they're too busy dealing with transports arriving for that shift. So actually she gets ignored at first. Eventually they do decide to follow up this case. Her friend failed to arrive at work. She's found later to have taken refuge in a local cottage where the people living there looked after her. But the last her friend had seen of her was her sort of screaming in the darkness. That's the sort of case the guards are having to deal with. There is another occasion where there is actually what they call a peeping Tom in the Church Green camp. And the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, the women living there, had been reporting that a strange man had been standing around the camp late at night and he'd been peering through the windows of some of the huts. And they narrowed down the suspicions to one of the Ministry of Works maintenance engineers who's meant to be looking after the boilers and things, who's meant to be on duty late at night. He rode a distinctive bicycle with a distinctive squeak, which, when heard, often caused a minor panic among the girls of Hut 147 and others nearby, as it's recorded. And one day he's found at the rear of the ladies' bathhouse, claims he was working on the building, and goes on his way. And I quote, examination of this bathhouse revealed the lengths to which someone has gone in their determination to observe the activities within. Holes have been made in the blackout curtains, two windows have been cut out completely, and a third has been started upon. The electric lights down one side of the bathhouse have been either dislocated, disconnected, or in some way rendered useless. And this confines users of the baths to those baths which can be observed from the rear where the windows have been removed. Some weeks later, this man is caught in the act, basically. And some of the occupants of Hut 147 go and get security guards and they go back and they catch him on a squeaky bicycle at the scene of the crime. And they have him banged to rights. Alan Bradshaw, who's the administrative chief at Bletchley, said he should be dispensed with at once as he is a nuisance, which seems a bit of an understatement. Henry Hayward says, nasty type, he scared the wits out of some of the WAFs, and the sooner he's cleared out, the better it will be for all of us. He seems to take it a bit more seriously. It turns out this man was also able to hand in somebody else, another maintenance man who was engaged in similar behaviour at the army camp as well. So the security guards are having to deal with issues of national security, and they're also having to deal with everyday petty criminality of the sort you see everywhere else, on top of their duty to keep the park secret.
How do we know about these stories? Are these anecdotes from oral history, for example, from our veterans' interviews, or are these all in the official record?
When they have one of these cases, they write up reports, they write statements, and these are all in the files and we can read them today. So we have a very good record of what happened in a lot of these cases. Most of my anecdotes are out of those files. And we also know a lot about the everyday experience and these sorts of everyday happenings from, of course, the veterans and their oral histories.
saw these examples of criminality happening actually on site. Were people working here not vetted, Tony?
They were, but vetting was done for a specific purpose, and that was to say, are we employing people who are likely to be passing on secrets? And with the best will in the world, the sort of behaviours that we're talking about are ordinary criminality. They're not treachery. In effect, what happened was that the names of anybody who was being considered for employment were sent to MI5. And MI5 would then go to local police forces to find out if there was anything known against any of the individuals who were being considered for recruitment. In practice, this would mean, are there criminal records that suggest that this person is a bad person? But the thing they were particularly interested in was political sympathies. Were people members of or sympathisers with either the Communist Party or Mosley's fascists? And some people did get through because there were no records of what they were. In 1940, I think Alistair Denniston was very surprised to find an MI5 delegation at the gates of Bletchley Park coming to look at Muriel Wright. She was a woman who was working here, and it had been discovered during investigations of a particularly serious case of treachery where information was being passed through the Italian embassy to the Germans, that this woman was a member of the British Union of Fascists. It turned out in the end that this had been a purely social thing and she had no political bone in her body. Interestingly, she was having an affair with Ian Fleming and had been for a number of years, and he'd found a congenial job. Perhaps more worrying is the fact that a man called Duncan Taylor was posted to Bletchley by RAF intelligence. He was an officer in the Royal Air Force. He was married to the sister of Ursula Kuczynski, well known perhaps to many listeners as Agent Sonia. She was from a family of dedicated German communist agents, but she seems to have slipped through, as do several fellow travellers, through the nets of the police. We'll come on to talk about John Cairncross, who's probably the best known of the wrong-uns, if you like, who came to Bletchley Park. But I would make the point that in an organisation of 10,000 people with a fairly strict need-to-know policy in place throughout the war, the amount of information that any individual would have access to that would mean anything to once it had been passed through the Soviet embassy in London back to Moscow would be very limited. Very few people had access to really important secrets, the sort of thing that would say the enemy will attack in 24 days' time or anything like that. Most people were only handling very fragmentary information. So though they're people who shouldn't have been here, perhaps it wasn't such a catastrophe that they had actually managed to get in.
As we've said, we always get asked about how was the Bletchley Park secret kept. And connected to that, we often get asked, were there any German spies at Bletchley Park?
The simple answer to the second part of the question is, as far as we're aware, there were no German spies at Bletchley Park. The German intelligence activity in the UK was, as far as we know, pretty much cleaned up by MI5 in the very early days of the war. And the efforts of the Abwehr to insert more spies into the UK were, in some cases, laughable in their ineptitude. Slight difficulty is, if there were successful spies, we'd have never heard of them.
True.
But as far as we're aware, there were no Nazi spies in Bletchley. But we do know, famously, of course, Tony's already mentioned him, of John Cairncross, who was employed in Bletchley from 1942 and was in the pay of the Soviet intelligence services.
Can you tell us a bit more about Cairncross and his background? Where did he come from?
He was a Scot. He came from Lanarkshire. His background was quite modest. His mother was a schoolteacher. His father ran an ironmonger shop. But they were clearly quite a bright family because he and his brothers all went to university and were, one of his brothers was successful academically. John Cairncross himself went to University of Glasgow initially and then studied at the Sorbonne and at Trinity College, Cambridge. So he was a linguist. He studied French and German. And indeed, in later life, he went on to become an academic in the United States. And he studied and wrote academic books about French literature. So a bright guy. Even his brother, though, said that he was quite a spiky personality. He wasn't a particularly sociable kind of guy. Traditionally, Cairncross is known as the fifth man of the Cambridge Five. But although he went to Cambridge, in a way, he's quite different from the others because his background wasn't anything like as socially elite as the others. And he didn't have the same easy social skills and manner as, for example, Philby. But he gets involved in all of this business while he's at Cambridge University.
He was a Soviet sympathiser, but do we know if he was actually a communist?
It's a bit difficult to tell because one of the main sources for understanding Cairncross is his own autobiography, which he wrote in 1997. He lived to a ripe old age. But his autobiography is quite self-serving and it's difficult to know what in there is completely true and what isn't. However, the general version of events is that when he was at Cambridge, he never joined the Communist Party of Great Britain outright. He didn't pay a subscription and go along to meetings. But one of the features of Cambridge in particular at that period was that there were a lot of very left-leaning students. You're in an era when fascism was on the rise. The Spanish Civil War breaks out later on in the 1930s. And so a lot of people are drawn to the left due to their opposition to fascism and to the right. And Cairncross excuses himself along the lines of his argument is that mainstream Britain wasn't doing enough, and the politics of mainstream Britain wasn't doing enough to curb fascism and the rise of fascism in Europe, and that the only people who were taking fascism seriously as a threat to the Western way of life were the communists and the left. And there were enough quasi-communist clubs and social groups at Cambridge University that you didn't need to join the party to meet people of a like mind. You could go to philosophy clubs or whatever else and meet other communists or, as Tony said, fellow travellers. I think had he been, you know, an ordinary working man, in order to meet other communists, he would have had to pay a subscription to the party and go to party meetings. But because he's at Cambridge, he doesn't actually need to do that because he's meeting enough people that he sympathises with anyway. But he certainly makes himself well enough known in left-wing circles for Soviet intelligence to take an interest in him. And there's a guy called James Klugman, who was the NKVD, KGB. I'm not exactly sure of the precise nomenclature for the Soviet intelligence in that period, but they have people in Cambridge who are looking out for people who they can potentially use in the future. And he is groomed, if you like, at that period. His brother actually commented that he might have had a successful academic career at Cambridge, but while he was doing his studies, he didn't really network enough. He didn't make enough friends in the right circles to go on and immediately be a scholar of French literature at Cambridge. So he had to take his talents elsewhere. He sat the civil service exam when he leaves Cambridge and the entrance exam for the Foreign Office, because in those days, well, even today, I think, well, certainly when I tried, you'd sat a written exam to join the civil service. He comes first in his intake, both for the civil service and for the Foreign Office. So he's clearly a bright guy who can do exams, even if he's not great down the pub. And the result of this is he joins the Foreign Office in 1937. He's working as an assistant to Lord Hankey, who is a cabinet minister at the time. And amongst other things, he's sitting on a number of scientific committees. So he has access to the higher levels of government and some quite sensitive committees and other activities. And this, of course, is exactly what the Soviets want him to do. They're very keen on all of this. He basically starts spying for the Russians at that period.
When was it that he kind of went from being a left-leaning person of interest to actually being recruited as a Soviet spy?
Well, it would seem that once he's in the Foreign Office, as soon as he's in a position to have access to useful material for the Russians, he starts passing it on. Mm-hmm. His argument in his autobiography is at this period is that it's all about the rise of fascism and he's helping the Soviets to be the bulwark against fascism that Britain isn't currently being. You can spin it how you like. He was still spying for the Russians. So he was providing material. And interestingly, when the wall came down and there was a brief period in the 90s when Soviet archives were accessible to researchers, quite a lot of material was identified in former Soviet archives at that point that showed that he had actually been handing over material. And so you can get a kind of a check-up on what he says in his autobiography from the Russian end of what was actually arriving at their end. Lord Hankey was a member of the committees in particular that were dealing with the British nuclear programme, the so-called Tube Alloys Project, which is the British precursor to the Manhattan Project and all that. And although Cairncross probably wasn't at the level where he was getting hold of genuine nuclear secrets in terms of technology, he was certainly in a position to pass on the fact that the British government were interested in these subjects and were pursuing projects in that area. So he's already handing over useful secrets to the Soviets. The reason he ends up at Bletchley Park is quite curious in a way that in 1942, he is of a junior enough grade in the Foreign Office that he is not in a reserved occupation. So there is a chance that he can be called up for military service. And indeed, he does receive his call-up papers. And this worries the Soviets because they're kind of, well, we like you in government. You getting a khaki uniform and going off to fight on the Italian front doesn't really help us. So they encourage him to find a way around getting conscripted. And one of his Soviet handlers actually nudges him towards a Foreign Office contact who is also a GCNCS contact. And by having lunch with this guy and saying, I don't want to join the army, I'm much too useful, I speak French, German and all this, he manages to persuade the powers that be to give him a job at Bletchley. And so he avoids going into the military and arrives at Bletchley Park in June 1942.
Bletchley Station. Cambridge train, platform 2.
And what did he actually do at Bletchley Park?
This was something Tony was referring to earlier. Many of the people at Bletchley Park were in jobs where they didn't have access to worthwhile secrets from the point of view of an enemy power. Cairncross, because of his languages, actually lands in the heart of the operation. He lands in Hut 3. And in Hut 3, he is responsible for translating and redrafting the process called emending of actual ultra messages of Enigma traffic. So these messages are coming into the hut, and the team he's in, their job is to translate them into English, fill in missing words, unpick abbreviations, those sorts of jobs. So his Soviet handlers must have been delighted because this has sort of dropped him right in the middle of kind of the heart of the Bletchley operation. And he actually, despite all the stuff we've talked about, he finds it quite easy to steal secrets. Because, again, as Tony was saying, the volume of paperwork that's passing through Hut 3, they're being fed by Hut 6, literally thousands of broken Enigma messages every day on slips of paper. They're generating translations of these on other slips of paper. These are then being teleprinted. There's a whole process going on which is generating enormous amounts of paperwork. And Cairncross describes the fact that this stuff was literally lying on the floor in the hut. And so he picks up bundles of intercept and, in his own words, hides them down his trousers, which sounds comically basic in a way, but the security, everything we've talked about so far, he would have been a known face to the guys on the gate. He previously worked at the Foreign Office. He was considered to be one of us. And so he slips through that net because there is no way you can actually detect somebody if they're going to do that. That whole basis of trust that's existed. And they're generating so much paper in Hut 3 that, you see, why isn't there a document trail? Why isn't everything getting signed for? It's just impractical in a wartime situation. So he takes these bundles of papers, he puts them down his trousers, he meets his handler in London, and he hands over the information. He carries on doing this through late 1942 and into 1943. In 1943, interestingly, he basically decides he doesn't want to work at Bletchley anymore because he doesn't like it.
Why not?
He didn't like the shifts. He reckoned the shifts were making him ill. Oh. And, you know, bless him, petal. He kind of goes, I don't want to do this anymore. And the Russians must have been like, oh my, you're great, you're right in the heart of Bletchley Park. Why can you not carry on? And he goes, well, I'm getting ill. It's a bit rubbish. I don't want to do it anymore. And again, potentially with the help of Soviet influence, he manages to move to a job in MI6. And he moves off to the Secret Intelligence Service and departs from Bletchley after about a year. He carried on working for MI6 for the rest of the war, took on a job in the Treasury after the war. So he remains in the sort of establishment right up till the early 1950s. Finally, in the 1950s, stuff starts to come out that he might be a bit dodgy. And he quits the civil service and departs ultimately to America, where he becomes a university academic. And then after that, he has a sort of wandering life. He lives in France for a number of years. And increasingly, as the whole story of the Cambridge Five emerges, more and more information emerges about what he's been up to.
What sort of damage did he do in terms of his time at Bletchley Park?
Well, this is one of the more interesting aspects of his story. And this is where I think, you know, getting Tony's two penneth on this would be really interesting, because he is stealing this material. His autobiography is subtitled The Man Who Changed the Course of World War II.
Modestly.
Modestly titled, yeah. You know. But the point is, in the spring of 1943, the British are sharing ultra-derived intelligence directly with Stalin anyway. So information is being sent. The Russians aren't being told that it's Sigin of Broken Enigma. They're just told this is intelligence that the British have, and it's being passed to the Russians. So it's relatively unlikely that the kind of information he was getting in bundles of 10, 20 Enigma messages stuffed down his trousers was actually particularly relevant to the Soviets. The case that always comes up is the Battle of Kursk, Operation Citadel, which happens in the summer of 1943. And there's a separate story, which we've talked about in this podcast before, about when Bletchley Park starts to break Lorentz traffic, fish, they start to read high-level traffic that is associated with the German preparations for the Battle of Kursk. And it's one of the early successes of the whole fish-breaking, Lorentz-breaking operation. And Cairncross refers to stealing fish material, which was also coming through Hut 3. So the people that think Cairncross mattered will quote this and say that this amazing high-level intelligence about the Germans helps the Russians to win the Battle of Kursk. It probably doesn't. Soviet intelligence about the Germans on the Eastern Front at the tactical level is really good by the summer of 1943 anyway, and I don't think a few Enigma messages here or there is mattering very much. And also, most of those Enigma messages are probably being passed on through official channels anyway. So it's difficult to say whether he did anything that really made a great deal of difference. Some writers on intelligence have kind of blown up his part and said that he explained to the Russians how to break Enigma, or that he explained to the Russians even how to break Lorentz. But I think those of us in this room would think that that's pretty unlikely. I'm looking at Tony now, and he's nodding.
I think, he wasn't a cryptanalyst. There was no way he could have simply explained how it worked. And I agree with David. I think the value of the specific pieces of intelligence that he passed to the Soviets in terms of the Battle of Kursk were not in any way the things that changed the course of the battle. So in terms of his value to the Soviets during the Second World War, I don't believe it's the intelligence that he passed that was significant. It was perhaps the biggest secret of all that electromechanical encryption was vulnerable to electromechanical cryptanalysis, and that by putting enough brain power and resource into it, the British had managed to break the most complex systems that the Germans were using. And the significance of that is that by the end of the 1940s, the Soviets had moved away from using any sort of electromechanical encryption that was vulnerable to the sort of attacks that the British were doing. The Soviets captured Enigma machines, they captured setting sheets, they captured Lorentz machines. They were able to work out how these things worked. They knew long before they were capable of designing and building a Colossus that the most complex systems that the Germans had created could be broken, and ensured that the systems they developed that were in use during the Cold War would not be vulnerable in the same way. So they left the Allies, who had reasonable hopes at the beginning of the Cold War that cryptanalysis should achieve the same level of success against the Soviets as it had against the Germans, in a completely different position and having to rely on completely different techniques. So from that point of view, Cairncross was an incredibly valuable agent for the Soviets.
One of the interesting things about him is that he's not prosecuted at any point, and he's able to write his memoirs in the 90s, you know, relatively freely. And you get the sense that MI5 and the other powers that be have kind of either let sleeping dogs lie or ultimately decided that, you know, they're not going to make a fuss about what he did. But it sounds like that you, Tony, believe that the damage he did to Britain and to the West in the Cold War was actually pretty significant.
Yes, but I think when he was confronted with evidence that he worked for the Soviets and whatever deal was done, the same sort of deal as was done with Blunt, to make some sort of confession in return for immunity from prosecution, won't have been carried out by anybody who had the slightest understanding of what he was doing. All they would know was that at Bletchley he was dealing with intercepted German messages, because it wasn't until 1974 that the world at large, which would include the people who were doing interrogations at MI5, actually knew about the successes that had happened here.
And that brings us to a point that you alluded to earlier, which is perhaps an interesting thing to finish on, which is not only did MI5 not know what was happening at Bletchley, but half the people at Bletchley didn't know what was happening at Bletchley.
Yeah.
And actually, too much secrecy, too much compartmentalisation isn't necessarily healthy at the end of the day.
It's perhaps the biggest problem that you can put at the door of need to know. If you look at the sort of access that he had to material, the fact that nobody knew what he was doing, the fact that nobody in Bletchley would have understood anyway what was going on, it made it relatively straightforward for him to reveal this one big secret that everybody else assumed had been kept perfectly.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.